Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Once again with Matt Swanson, creator of Boring Rails. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason.
So Matt, you and I are going to be talking about an interesting topic today. There is a document or a guide that kind of made the rounds on Reddit and Twitter recently. It was this Shopify guide, or at least it was a guide that was hosted on a Shopify domain called Upgrow. And it got an interesting reception on Reddit. The response seemed fairly positive, although there was a lot of criticism on Reddit also. I have a lot of opinions about what the guide was. I'm sure, well, I know because you and I talked pre-show that you have a lot of opinions about it too. And I thought we could kind of discuss that. And then also, just like in reaction to that, I'd like to talk about how I organize my Rails apps, which is something I've talked about on the show a little bit already, of course. But there's some stuff that I haven't talked about so much that I'd like to talk about, and maybe you can share your thoughts in that area too. So let's get into it. I'll just ask you, Matt, what did you think of the Shopify Upgrow guide?
Yeah, so I came across this. I think I saw it on Twitter first, and I just from the tweet, I was sort of intrigued because Shopify is sort of held in very high regard in the Rails community as sort of the antidote to the meme of Rails can't scale, since Shopify is, a massive scale beyond anything I've ever, built or sort of have even ambitions to build. And they've been sort of notorious for their sticking with Rails, and they've done a lot of great work sort of upstreaming things back to the framework. And when I think of it, I think of Shopify in the kind of big three of like Shopify, GitHub, and Basecamp as sort of the three large scale Rails installations where you can sort of use as cover to get around that, Rails can't scale, or you have to rebuild your app once you're out of, startup land. So I was interested in seeing anything really that, Shopify was going to release about how they build Rails apps. I think in the absence of sort of going to work at Shopify, documents like this are really helpful in just seeing how they think about things and seeing how different teams have dealt with problems that I'm sure we all face. So that was kind of my initial reaction. And so I kind of opened up the document, and the way it's sort of laid out is like, Rails is really great at, balancing business value and speed and that. And early on in the document, there's a guide on code smells in Rails apps. And I was sort of nodding my head along with like, yep, like these are reasonable things that I think I've run into and most people start to run into. I can just read off a couple of them. We don't have to go in depth, but, things like really complicated routes in the, your routes.rb file, lot of issues with, complicated controllers with a lot of before actions, too much code in views, confusion around callbacks. So I was kind of nodding my head along. And then we started getting to some of them that I hadn't really considered code smells myself. The one that really jumped out to me was active record associations. So the
document, I want to talk about that one. And by the way, before we go even further, it might be a good idea just to talk about, for anybody who hasn't encountered this yet, just what was it? And to me, it seemed like what it was like kind of a proposal for a way to write Rails apps in a different way that's better than kind of the standard way of writing Rails apps. Was that kind of your impression of what this guide was attempting to be?
Yeah, I think the framing was like, hey, Rails is great, but there's a lot of common issues. And, this is, quoting from the document, that's not necessarily my opinion, but that Rails doesn't really provide you tools to fix these problems. So here are, a set of alternative, tools. And there's actually like some code that comes with it. So there's like libraries that sort of implement some of the patterns that they're advocating for.
And just to contextualize the whole thing, this idea is not particularly new. I remember encountering similar ideas years ago and even having similar ideas myself, where we say, okay, active record kind of becomes problematic as your Rails application grows. So what if we add some separation and we have kind of a repository layer and then a business logic layer so that we can keep those concerns separate? And there's things like Trailblazer, which I've only looked into very lightly, just enough to tell that I don't think I want to use it. And then other things like DryRB, which similarly, I kind of like looked at DryRB, couldn't really tell what it was, not that interested in it. It didn't end up trying to do anything with it. So there have been over the years other attempts to do this kind of thing. This is just kind of the latest one of these.
Yeah, so I kind of think about these as sort of like alternative architectures to the out-of-the-box, Rails Rails recommendations. And yeah, this is not certainly a new thing that happens in the Rails world. It seems like it's kind of a cyclical thing. Every like 2 or 3 years, one of these pops up. And I mean, you can trace this all the way back to, like the Rails 2, Rails 3 days with MERB being the sort of alternative that said, hey, like a lot of this Rails stuff is good, but we want to make a bunch of breaking changes. And ultimately that project was merged back in and a lot of the ideas are sort of incorporated into the Rails 3 release.
Yeah.
So yeah, this does seem kind of like it was along those lines. So that's sort of, as I got into the document, what I was expecting, like here are some problems and, here are the solutions. And I saw some familiar terms and concepts among those solutions.
Yeah, my reaction was similar to yours in that when I was reading the early parts of it, I was like, okay, yeah, these are in fact the common problems experienced with Rails projects. These are common mistakes. I was in full agreement. And then we started to get into some questionable territory. So the first part of the guide was like, and by the way, this guide has been taken offline for whatever reason. The web portion, at least, there's still like a GitHub mirror or something that you can get to. But the first part was just like text, and it was just laying out like, here's what the problem is. And then we started getting into code and suggestions for solutions and stuff like that. And that's the point at which we got into some questionable stuff. And Matt, you had brought up before I interrupted about active record associations being a code smell.
Yeah, so that was kind of the first section where I sort of paused and I said, this is like contrary to what I would think. So, I was actually of the opinion of like, this is maybe interesting. Like maybe if I think about Shopify scale or maybe they've encountered something where they've said like, oh yeah, this is actually a problem. There's like bad performance issues or, we find that you're not ever necessarily querying things with these associations. And a lot of times people will sort of fill out your entire like tree of objects and then, you know, never access them that way. And I was like, huh, okay, maybe there's something here. And I think part of it was just like, oh, if Shopify is saying that this is a code smell, like that's worth investigating, at least in my mind. And I think that kind of circles into the bigger picture that maybe we'll get into a little bit later around like the context of this document. And like you said, it's been sort of, you know, pulled down and you know, maybe it was overstating what actually the production level usage of this was, or the opinion of the authors was maybe not widely reflected among, you know, all the Shopify engineering staff or anything like that.
Yeah. And by the way, I do want to say that we're certainly not trying to like be mean to the author of this document. I think I speak for both of us when I say that that's not our goal to like criticize the author, but I think some of the ideas should be criticized. 'Cause what happened was this article got a mixed reception, but in a lot of places it got a very positive reception, people saying this is a good idea. And what I would hate is for people to see this and think that these are all good ideas and they should try them, because that would lead to heartbreak in a lot of these cases, I think. So yeah, there's this code smell area. Active record associations are a code smell. That to me is like, frankly, just nonsense. And then another item was model methods are a code smell. And that's an interesting one, because that's not so simple to dismiss.
Yeah.
Because there's something to that. And in order to talk about that, I think we have to frame some things a little bit. When we say model methods, what do we mean by model? And so I think what the author meant by that is like just an active record model. Because it is true that if you have an active record model and you just have a million methods in that model, then that's bad. But if you conceive of a model the way I conceive of a model, which is just an object that represents some of your domain logic, then, you know, having methods in models isn't a smell, because objects have methods. That's the way OOP works. But in order for that to be true, you have to have kind of a broader conception of what a model is. And so that's an interesting one where I wouldn't like agree or disagree with it. I think it's like a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah. And I think the interesting part is that later on in the document, they sort of describe, and you can kind of see, like, at least it helped me put myself in the shoes of the authors, when they made a lot of distinction between how in Rails we say that a model is an active record object, and they sort of are deliberate in defining, you know, those are what they would call like a record type, which is and then a model could just be, you know, a plain Ruby object. So I think they went as far as to say something like, you know, Rails should rename, you know, their stuff to be, you know, records, not models, and you should separate them. This is definitely, I won't say it's like a bad idea. It's definitely like not a Rails idea. It all stems back to this, for better or worse, sort of design pattern. I don't even know what the right word is here, but the sort of abuse of design pattern names, maybe, in that, you know, there was a pattern in sort of software literature that was like the active record pattern, which is not the pattern that Rails actually implemented when it made a thing called active record. So
really?
Because
I have that book, Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture by Martin Fowler. And my understanding is that DHH was kind of inspired by some of the patterns in that book. And so the you know, active record is not a Rails unique thing. It existed before Rails. And my understanding was that DHH kind of took that active record pattern from that book and implemented it in Rails. But your understanding is that the Rails implementation is something different from the Rails agnostic pattern?
That's my understanding, is that the agnostic pattern is more just about the like data access and from the database specifically, and sort of the mapping of fields to the object. So more like the pure ORM side. And then, you know, there's a different pattern, which is one that sort of handles the kind of what we know of Active Record as far as, you know, querying and creating records from that model. So the thing that happens, I think, is that folks have different backgrounds from other languages and ecosystems, and things sort of get mixed up and mixed around. And like, you know, you take how are database ORMs built in Java? How are they built in Elixir? How are they built in Node? And sort of they all choose slightly different ways to separate them. Like if you have ever worked in a Java Spring app, you know, first, I'm sorry. And second, you'll notice that there's a lot more of a inclination to have like plain Java objects that are mapped, like that map from your database to like Java objects. And then you have other things like, you know, repositories to, you know, do the querying and creating. And so they've sort of separated out the database piece from the querying and creation piece. And there are reasons for that, and that, you know, if you're trying to isolate from your external dependency of the database, like that can be good. But all this to say is like, those aren't necessarily wrong patterns. They're just like, they're almost antithetical to how Rails wants you to set up your database models. And so certainly you can go that way, but you're really fighting against the framework. And at that point, like, I would almost ask, are you better off just like not using Rails and using, you know, using Sinatra or using a different language that has, you know, frameworks that are more in line with the architecture patterns that you're interested in?
Yeah, here's my issue with all these attempts to like do something other than Active Record or to do something different with Active Record. You know, we have a million examples of Active Record being great or good or just okay or bad. Like we have the whole spectrum of examples. But then when you go to these other design patterns, like the data mapper pattern is another one that I've like heard a lot about. But there's not really examples of like, hey, GitHub uses the data mapper pattern and it works out great for them. And here's exactly how they do it. Like we don't have examples like that. Everything that I've ever seen, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist, I'm just saying that everything that I've ever seen is just hypothetical. And so it's hard for me to go in that direction when I don't know of any examples of real applications that are doing it in a certain way. Like I've never seen an example from an actual production application that doesn't use Active Record and does it successfully. So that makes it tough to buy.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a weak argument, but I think there is some like pragmatism that has to be applied to some of these choices of like, if you're going to go off of the golden path of Rails and you're going to say, I'm going to use data mapper, or I'm going to use repository pattern, or I'm going to use pull in some pieces from Trailblazer or, you know, the DryRB project or things like that, like that's fine. But I think you risk that like you pay a cost for not going with the consensus. And certainly there are cases where maybe your application truly does have special database access needs. Like, but I think that's more like if you're building like a database client or something, not that you're just building an application that happens to talk to a database and you like this style versus, you know, the Active Record style. Because you're losing out on so many resources, right? You're gonna have trouble finding, you know, articles, documentation, prior art.
Every time you hire somebody, they're gonna have to get used to your unusual way of doing it.
Yep, and you know, when new updates come out to the Rails framework, like I know that Active Record is not gonna break, but you know, you have to wait for the delay for, you know, your third parties to update, and then if there's breaking changes or things like that, you may end up with a lot of trouble in sort of upgrading. And I don't
so
know.
I never found these to be
sort of worth the cost. But maybe I haven't encountered a case where I truly did like have special, unique, you know, database access needs.
Well, I want to comment on something you said. You said that like you pay a certain cost for not doing it the standard way, or however you put it. And that's certainly true. what I want to advocate, and maybe we can get into this a little bit more in a bit, but I want to advocate for doing it in a way that is the standard way to a certain degree, and then divergent to a certain degree also, because I have a way of organizing my models that is, in my experience, uncommon, but I think it also works out really well, and it doesn't completely just throw away active record. I'm using active record. I'm just using active record in what I think is a smart way. But maybe we can get to that in a bit, because I'm hoping we can kind of go through the criticisms of the guide, and then we can talk about how we do things. One other of the code smells that I want to comment on, it said private methods are a code smell. That one is pretty much just kind of invalid in my mind, because it's sure, if you have a bunch of methods in a class, then that's a code smell, but whether they're private or public is not really that important of a distinction. It's whether there's a lot of them. Private methods are a useful thing, and so like the mere presence of private methods is not a code smell. Would you agree with that, Matt?
Yeah, I think so. At least not enough to categorically say that if you see like a block of private methods, then this is bad and should be, you know, refactored.
Yeah. Okay. So there's something that I want to say that like I think would make a good transition from talking about the guide to talking about how we organize Rails apps. But before I mention anything to do with that, did you have anything to say about the guide itself, Matt? Anything else you want to cover?
No, I think maybe just one observation that I've had that's kind of interesting is that whenever I see these types of alternative architectures, it always feels to me like it's more folks are quibbling with sort of the implementation, and they sometimes wrap that up in saying that like Rails doesn't provide a way to do this. And I think really what they're saying is Rails doesn't provide a way to do this that I myself like. So I can remember, you know, the big architecture-y type discussions that have happened over the years around things like interactors or service objects or policy objects, or in this document, there's things that they call like inputs. And, you know, I'm thinking of like the hexagonal architecture and some of these things that have been popular. And I think I've always found that if you sort of dig, like Rails does have stuff to do this, and maybe people just don't like the particular implementation. So maybe people don't like, you know, concerns, or they don't like, you know, plain old Ruby objects in the models folder. So they come up with something else. Maybe they don't like, you know, making an object and having it include the active model thing to make like a form object, but they want to make their own thing that's called a form object. And so I think that's always something to think about, is even if you don't necessarily agree with this, or even if the implementations of the sort of fixes are not something you want to do, it can be worth thinking about like, okay, how would I do this in just, you know, vanilla Rails, or like, you know, what would DHH do in this case? Oh, he would, you know, instead of writing like a policy, he would just say, well, why don't you just write, you know, a custom validation class that's already baked into the framework and be on your way.
I think a big reason why these alternative ideas keep popping up, but none of them really stick, is that it's much easier to criticize the current state of existing things than it is to create a new thing that works and lasts. I don't want to like get all political or something like that, but like one example is like, capitalism is bad, you know, it has problems for sure, and so let's burn it all down and create something new under a different economic system. It's like, no. That's as political as I'll get right now, because I don't want to go down that road. But okay, so there's one sentence from this guide that I think is really interesting, and it relates back to like interactors and service objects and all that kind of stuff. It says, okay, so there's this idea from this guide called actions, and it's kind of like, you know, command pattern type thing where it carries out a series of procedural steps. And the line says, actions are designed to be the centerpieces of business logic, coordinating all the steps required to process a user request. And the reason I thought that was really interesting is because there seems to be this common belief that programs are composed of series of steps to be carried out.
Yeah.
And that's just so different from the way that I conceive of programs. And that touches on the concept of declarative programming versus imperative. And this is where we can kind of transition from the UpGrow guide to at least how I organize my Rails applications. So I was sharing this example of declarative versus imperative to somebody I work with today. I was using an analogy saying like, okay, here's an example of an imperative style. Get two pieces of bread. On one piece of bread, put some peanut butter. On the other, put some jelly. Then put the two pieces of bread together, put it on a plate, and give it to me. That's imperative. And then declarative would be to say, hey, give me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And to me, declarative programming is almost always much easier to understand. And there are maybe some things that are inherently imperative, and so they call for imperative code. But in my experience, the vast majority of code can be structured in a declarative way. And in my experience, the vast majority of that code is much easier to understand when it's structured declaratively than imperatively. How about you, Matt? Do you have any thoughts on declarative versus imperative?
Yeah, I think when you go through that example, like I think I would agree that like saying, you know, like the higher level of abstraction there of like, you know, create a sandwich or something is definitely where my head would go. I think it's kind of interesting that I would also say that like as you go lower and lower down the abstraction, you know, tree or whatever, I think at the leaf node, you probably are writing a fairly imperative code of like here, you know, the steps to do, you know, query for this record, update these fields, like call save. And that's the style that I sort of gravitate towards.
Which style, the declarative style?
I don't know if I would even frame it like that, but just, you know, trying to match the levels of abstraction so that, yeah, at a high level, you're calling, you know, make a sandwich. But, you know, once you get into that implementation, then it starts breaking down into, you know, smaller and smaller steps that are starting to look more and more imperative.
Yeah. And another more realistic example is like, I would not create a method called like get customers that does customer.all. Bad example of what would be in that, but I wouldn't make something called get customers. I would have it just be called customers, and it would return the set of customers. It's saying, and this is the whole idea with declarative versus imperative, I think it's better to say what you want than to say how you want it. And of course, you're right that once you get down to the leaf nodes, it pretty much has to be imperative, but all the surrounding stuff is declarative, which makes it pretty easy to understand. So the way that I like to try to organize my Rails apps is just using plain old object-oriented programming. And so my models will be a mixture of models that inherit from Active Record and Poros, plain old Ruby objects. I did a check the other day, and I don't remember the ratio, but the majority of my models are Poros as opposed to Active Record models. And again, I like to create those in a declarative style. And I have fat models and skinny controllers, but I don't mean fat models in the sense that each individual model is large, because small classes are easier to understand than big ones. I mean fat models in the sense that most of my code lives in my model as opposed to my controller or somewhere else. And I don't use service objects or interactors or anything like that. It's all just models and poros and then things like jobs and stuff like that.
Yep.
How about you, Matt? What is kind of your general approach to keeping your Rails apps organized?
Yeah, I think I actually am really similar to your guest on the last episode who talked a lot about namespaced models and extracting these, you know, small objects that aren't necessarily active record base objects. I tweeted out an example the other day that I think is good. Like, if you imagine that you had a project, you're making, you know, a task management application, you have a project model, and that's an active record model that, you know, hooks up to the database. But then let's say you had a method on that model where you wanted to find related projects, and maybe a related project is, you know, projects that are for the same customer that are not, completed or something. And so I think you might be tempted to just, you know, start writing your active record, you know, where and your joins and your SQL calls straight on a method on that model, on the project's model. But something I've been trying to do more lately, and I think has worked out really well, is extracting an object that is called related projects. And that takes in a project and has a, you know, related projects method that does all that querying. So that
are you talking about a query object or something different?
Yeah. So in that case, it would be a query object. So you'd have your project object that then itself can create a related projects object to do the querying for those, you know, particular, you know, business rules that you want to implement.
Yeah, I like to do the same thing. When you have maybe there's a relatively complex query that is kind of peripheral to the essence of a certain class, I'll take that out of the main class and I'll create my own object. Query objects are especially helpful when you want to these big queries can be really hard to understand, especially when the queries are highly configurable. Mm-hmm. And so it can be super helpful to move that out into its own class. Okay, what else?
So that's the one that I think I probably get the most use from is objects like that. I can think of other places where I've made so let's say that you can assign those projects to different users within the system. So I might make an eligible assignee class that handles the logic for determining, you know, who it can be assigned to. So as far as that goes, I do a lot of query object models, and those just live in my models folder, and I try to namespace them into the records that they're associated with. And then when it comes to more, I guess, creation type things, I've been liking the concerns for that. So things if a project can be assigned, I'll make, you know, an assignable concern that deals with how do we assign projects, and if there's any other side effects of that around, you know, do we need to send notifications to people when they get assigned to a project, things like that. So those are the two that spring to mind to me as alternatives to just throwing code in an active record model that gets larger and larger, is pulling out a concern or pulling out a query object.
Yeah, the thing is, you really don't need a lot of fancy concepts in order for things to work out well, because, you know, I have this hypothesis as to why, one reason at least, why service objects and interactors and all these sorts of things are attractive ideas to people. And one idea is that people see these slots where code goes in Rails, like controllers and models and all that stuff. And it works out great to put those things in slots. But then there comes a point where your app grows so large that you run out of slots. And so the question is, okay, I have this extra code. It doesn't fit into these slots all that well. I need more slots to put these things in. And so service objects and interactors, they look like slots, and it looks like an answer. But what seems to maybe not occur to a lot of people is that, or maybe they're just not exposed to these ideas yet, is that object-oriented programming is extremely powerful and can do a lot without any of these design patterns. And by the way, service objects and interactors, unless I'm wildly mistaken, these things are not design patterns. A design pattern is something with a specific problem and a specific solution to that problem. Service objects aren't that kind of thing. Take, for example, the decorator pattern. That's a solution to a specific problem. Service objects and interactors, what I've seen on the teams I've worked on that have used those things, are basically like, hey, here's how we should write all our code now. And that's not a mm-hmm. pattern when it's just, here's how we should organize all of our code now. I just use object-oriented programming. And so there's not necessarily a whole lot more to say about it at that level, because you don't need anything more than that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and it sort of echoes back to earlier in the conversation. Like, Rails provides you folders to put stuff in, maybe you don't like the folders or what they're named, and that's certainly fine. But it kind of reminds me before of, there used to be, and I don't think it's a problem anymore with newer versions of Rails, but it used to be like actually super annoying to have to load in folders other than the blessed Rails folders. Like if you wanted to like auto load code from like a services folder, you had to like kind of tweak your config and say like, yeah, you need to like auto load out of here. And it's kind of interesting that it's sort of like, yeah, you can do that, but like, are you sure? If you just put it in the models folder instead of putting it in the actions folder or something, you don't have to configure it. It's going to work. It'll be great.
And I want to give a quick example of some of these applications of OOP, because I feel like maybe somebody could be listening and they hear me say, oh, just use OOP and you're good. You don't need anything else. It's like, okay, what does that mean? Because for me, it took me so many years to like grasp OOP, and I probably still don't even grasp it as well as I maybe even think I do. So here's a quick example. There's a feature of my application where this file needs to get outputted. It's this crazy proprietary file output format. It's like pipe delimited, and it's based on like an incredibly literal interpretation of what used to be a paper form. And so it makes like no sense in a lot of ways. And so it takes a lot of maneuvering to get this file to come out right. And so if I had just made like a big long function to output this line, it would have been impossible to understand. So I divided it up into a few objects. So one of these objects, and I'm pulling up my code as we speak. Okay, I got to contextualize this a little bit by saying what it's for. I work for a medical clinic. When a patient has an appointment, they have procedures done, and each one of those procedures has a corresponding charge. We take the charges for a period of time, let's say all the appointments for a week, we take all those charges, we put them into this pipe delimited file, then send that file to this place called the clearinghouse. They talk to the insurance companies, and the insurance companies send the money. So this piece of code is what takes those charges and puts them in this file. And so I have a namespace called ZERMED837P file, because that's what the file is called, but that's my main namespace. Then I have a few classes in here. One of the classes is just called line, and the line class represents one line of this file, and it has methods. Like, one method is fields with charges, and the other method is 2s, which converts it to a string, of course. Those are the only two methods in the class. Both of them are pretty small. And then I have this one called charge slot in the same namespace. Just a couple methods. There's value, diagnosis code, index, charge slots, charge slot, offsets. And so you can kind of see how like this style is not an imperative style. I'm not saying do this, then do this, then do this. I'm saying this is what this is. Here's how a line in this file is defined. Here's how a charge slot within a line is defined. And then I have something called a line serializer, which takes data and serializes it into a way that matches this desired file format. So that's just the example I wanted to give of how I'm using an OOP declarative format it's declarative and not imperative.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's a good example where you've sort of scoped it to a small piece of the app, right? You're not saying, oh, we need to rewrite our entire app, or any new feature needs to be set up like this. It's like, no, this is the problem. I can apply the solution. And I think that harks back to what you said about a design pattern being something that has here's a blueprint to solve this specific problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be clear, OOP is a paradigm, not a pattern. And because it's a paradigm, not a pattern, it makes sense to write entire applications using that paradigm. And that's how I've chosen to write mine. Maybe Matt, we can talk a little bit in closing about software advice in general and how to tell what's good advice and not good advice and stuff like that. But before we transition into that, anything else to say about organizing Rails and apps in general or anything like that?
Nope, I think that covers it.
Okay. So yeah, it gave me a little bit of unease to see this guide get so highly upvoted, which had had good advice and it had questionable advice too. And so the question is, how do you tell when you see any piece of advice, what's good advice and what's not good advice? I'm not sure that I can say right off the top of my head, but do you have any thoughts, yeah, Matt?
Yeah, I actually wrote an article somewhat recently about this. The article is somewhat hyperbolically titled, every article about software is wrong, or like all software advice is wrong. And I think the biggest problem with advice and even with this particular guide, and I had even sort of opened an issue on the guide before it was sort of removed from GitHub to just ask about, and that's context. So like, what is the context in which these people are operating? What were the problems that they had? And how did these fit in? Because certainly, you can ask something like, what JavaScript framework should you use? Or like, how should you architect your Rails application? And the answer is really that it just depends on so many things that are really hard to, they're really hard to communicate. And it's not as interesting, frankly, to write sort of a really nuanced article and where you're couching a lot of your language with it depends, and because it doesn't, it sort of can alienate your audience, and that gets into a whole nother topic of what is punchy writing that does well on the internet versus what is sort of actual good advice for you in your own situation. But we can think about it in this case, like Shopify is very unique, and maybe that's why I sort of held off on a lot of my critical judgment of this document originally, was like, maybe they just have such a different, unique set of problems. Like Shopify, if I'm remembering correctly, they hire something like 2,000 developers a year. And it's like, maybe working in a company like that or code bases like that is just actually so different that things like, never use an active record association makes sense.
That's true.
I just don't know.
Yeah, yeah. People on Reddit said something similar to that. Like, hey, don't criticize this advice because it might not be right for you at your small company, but Shopify is doing a whole different thing. But in reading the guide, I did not get the impression that it was saying, this is how we organize our apps at Shopify. I can't articulate quite right what, but something told me that the advice was not connected to anything real. And I don't know exactly what gave me that signal, but I definitely got that signal.
Well, I know for me, the for better or worse, all the code examples were sort of the most simple example of an article with comments. And I think that is definitely not a place where you're going to actually show the complexity that you're sort of arguing that you run into.
Yeah, to be fair, though,
one example.
Yeah. A lot of Martin Fowler books, they'll be full of code examples that are super, super simple things also. And it's really hard to write an example that's not super simple, as you know, I'm sure, because then it just becomes 100 pages long. I think maybe part of it was just there was a total absence of anything that said at Shopify, here's how we do blah, blah, blah. There was nothing like that. So I think maybe that's a clue that people can use. When you're reading the advice, is there any sign that it's born of experience rather than something somebody just dreamed up?
Yeah, I know something that DHH has been very big on is like, let's look at the code. So let's do like a bake off between two options and look at the same code, you know, in this new style versus like the style that I would write. And let's look at the code. Let's not discuss, you know, these big text paragraphs about, you know, this is more composable or maintainable or, you know, is less coupled. And it's like, you know, at a certain point, your eyes kind of glaze over and you're like, all these terms don't, it's not that they don't mean anything, but it's just like, you're not really arguing about a specific concrete thing where it's much easier to see, you know, which you prefer or which one actually in practice is more confusing or looks like it'll have more trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a hard thing. It's hard to give advice about when to take advice. In general, you know, most advice it's an unfortunate fact of reality. Most advice is not very good advice, whether it's programming advice or any kind of advice at all. So it's a good idea to be like just super skeptical of everything, but it's maybe kind of the thing that you have to gain an intuitive feel for over time. It's hard to just give a set of heuristics or something like that.
Yeah, I think something that is really interesting that I hope to kind of leave listeners of the podcast just some food for thought is just thinking about the survivorship bias, which is I'm not going to define it necessarily, but like think about like every like business podcast you've heard about like how you made it and how this like entrepreneur, you know, was very successful. And then sort of remember that for that one person, there was 99 other people that didn't succeed and you're not hearing any of their experiences or voices. So it can be really hard to separate out what is actually impactful and what is either, you know, random or luck or something like that. So at the end of my article about how all software advice is wrong, I kind of posed the hypothetical was like, when was the last time that you read an article from somebody that explained like how they really screwed up and got fired for like making a bad architecture decision? And like, I think it's super rare. And like, even if you do, it's usually someone who's sort of like, you know, repenting about how they saw the errors of their ways and they've like reformed. But now, now I've found the, you know, the right way to do things. So just that's something to keep in mind is that, you know, you're getting content that is skewed toward the extremes. It's like kind of heavily edited, lopsided, like the Instagramification of, you know, of your life. So it's not a unique problem to programming, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's one way to tell, dear listener, if you see advice, if it comes from me or from Matt, it's excellent advice. And you should absolutely take it. So that's sure. That's the gold standard.
We're on a podcast and not anyone can just make one of those, you know.
Exactly. Well, Matt, where can people go to find you online?
Yeah, you can find all my Rails related stuff at boringrails.com. And if you like that stuff, you should definitely follow me on Twitter, twitter.com. And my username is _Swanson. And I post Rails and Stimulus, Hotwire, Ruby testing, you know, product design tips and tricks there. So I try to keep it very, very high signal, low noise.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jason.